right, let me restore chat here. Hey, there are people here. Awesome. Pop this chat out. It's a little informal. Look, you're here with us, and it's Sunday, and who do I mean by us? Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Martinson. You're here with Evie as well.
Evie Botello. Hi.
Evie Botello. And Evie Botello, the love of my life.
Yep.
Hello.
Still engaged.
Still engaged. Hello, everyone. So today, you know, welcome into our home. It's Sunday here, and we're just going to, I'm having some water. Evie's having some tea. We're going to listen to your chats. Evie's monitoring the chats here, so if you see anything that we need to call out, just let me know.
Sure.
We have a whole new studio configuration here, so we're working things out. Bear with us. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a better experience for all concerned. And today, we got to talk about the whole Trump indictment, of course. I'm not here to parse the legal side of that so much. We'll talk a little bit so we have some grounding in what it is. But we do have to talk about the implications of it. And the implications of it bleed into this concept of an idea of a conversation called the national divorce. And I think that's an interesting concept. And I know divorce is a very laden term for a lot of folks, a lot of emotions in it. And it seems like hyperbole, but maybe not. So there's something there to talk about in terms of what happens when you finally determine that you're at a state of irreconcilable differences in a relationship. And it doesn't mean one party's bad or the other's good or vice versa. It simply means that you've come to a point where a relationship has run its course and the downstream pain of continuing that relationship will exceed any possible gain. So it's really a relationship thing. So we'll talk about that. And there are just...
Sound is a little low.
Sound is a little low. Is that what you're hearing here?
That's what I'm seeing.
All right. Just give me one second here then.
We've got a new system we're working with.
I will go back to this and we will see what is going on with the audio. You are right. It is low. So we're going to see if we can gain this up a little bit here. And gain this up a little bit here. I wish these were easier to use. Hello, check, check. There we go. So I'm now popping. Evie, make sure you talk in nice and close,
okay? Can you hear me?
How about you?
Which, is that me? Yep. I guess it could be a little louder.
Yeah, so I'm just going to keep working on this. You know, this is the most frustrating. See how I'm trying to drag it?
Yeah, it doesn't go.
And it just doesn't drag. It's one of the most frustrating controls there is.
Anyway, we're glad to be here with you guys. It's such a pleasure to be spending part of our Sunday afternoon with y'all. Thanks for joining us.
There we go. So I've got you driven as much as I can.
All right.
All right.
That's better, I think. Let us know in the chat. I'll be watching it.
All right. Better, they say. Thanks, Pat. All right. All good. Excellent. All right. So let's... You ready?
Yeah. Are you going to press buttons?
Well, what do you think about that? This topic set. I sort of sprung it on you here.
You did, like 4 minutes before. About the Trump indictment.
That and
about the national divorce.
Yeah.
About all the other pieces of topic. Honestly, I have been surprised to see what's going on in the world in my lifetime. You know, presumably, at least from what I remember, people, presidents were never treated this way. Former presidents were never treated this way. So to me, it just feels sort of salacious and silly that we're watching what's going on.
I'm so old, I remember when a president started a war of choice based on trumped up falsified evidence, killed a million Iraqis, and nothing happened to him.
Yep.
Or his advisors, or any of the Office of Special Plans, or anybody anywhere. That was a massive, massive fail. And of course, what had happened up to now was you sort of like, well, you know, presidents have to make hard choices, whatever. Anyway, we let some real serious stuff slide in the past. This thing that they're charging Trump with doesn't even come up to the level of silliness, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to compare a million dead Iraqis against a hush payment to a former porn star.
Yep.
That's literally the equivalence we're being asked to. Anyway, the gates are open now, though. So precedents, when they get set.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. So we got to talk about that.
It is. And it's a problem because there's so much else going on, as you know, in the world right now. As y'all, you know, I'm sure everyone is aware, there's just so much to be talking about. And this feels like a giant distraction. Like it's just taking our attention away from what really matters. But it's just my opinion.
Yep.
Says your microphone is still low.
Yours is still low?
No, says yours is.
I don't understand why that could be, because I got great sound on this end. So we'll have to work that out. That will be something on the YouTube side, because we have great, we've got good sound pumping in here. Don't know what to say about it at this stage. All right. Yeah, they're all criminals. That's right, Tessa. So they really are.
I'm sure you've gathered good stuff, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you got?
All right. Well, I do have some good stuff. So here, I'm actually driving this to Peking now. Evie, let's see what about yours here.
Okay.
You're going to have to just talk a little closer and louder.
I have to talk louder.
You just pretend you're a rock star and like right here. You want your lips
kiss
touching.
The microphone.
Kiss the microphone. All right. Good enough.
Nobody knows how shy I actually am. I am so shy. I'm painfully shy. This is actually really hard to do.
All right,
sometimes.
Let's talk about that.
No, I'm just saying. No, okay. I'm going to blush if you do it.
All right. So let's go here. So the Trump indictment. First off, let's just set the stage here. So what is this? What is this? In a Wall Street Journal opinion just came out March 31st. They said here, to recap how we got here, Ms. Daniels, Stormy Daniels, a pornographic film performer, alleges she had a fling with Mr. Trump in 2006. Now, that is nearly a decade before he entered the Republican primary for president. And once Mr. Trump became a candidate, Ms. Daniels began demanding money in exchange for her silence. By the way, whatever they spent, they didn't buy the silence real well, because she's out there just flapping it up. So that was whatever lawyers they had passing that money over did a bad job on the NDA and the non-disparagement clause. People should pay attention to those.
They should.
When you
actually
sign an NDA and you have a non-disparagement, it's actually
it's a contract.
It's a contract for starters. So you're obviously you have your honors on the line, but I got to tell you, you have legal consequences that are actually on the line. It's just part of being part of the professional world. Anyway. Carrying on, Mr. Trump obliged and his company, the Trump Organization, sent $130,000 to Ms. Daniels through Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, a one Michael Cohen. The expense was apparently recorded on the company's books as legal fees, which the indictment is expected to allege was a falsification of business records. The reason that's important is that falsification of business records is a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They want to get him on a felony. The reason they want to get Trump on a felony here is because once somebody's been indicted on a felony, they are no longer legally able to run for president. So
that's
if they
right.
can get him convicted on a felony. So this is it. Like, you can feel like there's people who just want Trump to be taken down so much they're willing to do anything.
Yeah.
Louder.
Yes. He was saying louder.
I'll keep pushing it till we get there.
Okay.
All right, this is the DA. This is the best picture he had taken of him, so I'm using it in the interest of fairness. He is another Soros-funded district attorney. Funny story. CNN just came out and said, oh no, he wasn't funded by Soros. Fact check, debunked. What had happened instead was Soros gave money to a cutout organization called the PAC, that then gave the money to Alvin Bragg. They said, oh no, he received money indirectly from Soros. But that's not like directly, like, oh, you morons. This is what I don't like about living in this country right now, is that we can't share common phrases, terms, not like this is simple. Like, no district attorney would ever be confused by the idea that if I said, oh no, I did not pay that contract killer to take out an ex-business partner. I gave that money to Evie, who gave it to them. I'm clean, right? They'd be like, that's not how that works. We'd still call that a direct contract connection. So anyway, this is the guy. I got a little piece cut off
Did
there.
Did she get in trouble, by the way, for violating that?
Not yet, but she could be.
Yeah.
I mean, she's got to be. She's. I think her 15 minutes of fame is more important to her than possible.
Mm.
She'll eat the legal fees, but she's, I think, depending on how they wrote it, and I haven't seen it. It would be something that they could charge. I mean, you know, take her. There could be legal consequences.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry that gets cut off a tiny bit there, but here's the story, just so we're all grounded in it. Mr. Bragg's political problem is that this charge is chump change, merely a misdemeanor under New York law. To ratchet up to a felony indictment, he had to show, among other things, that the falsification was designed to conceal another crime. The crime is believed to be a campaign finance violation That's an illegal corporate contribution by the Trump Organization to the Trump presidential campaign, which the false business reporting was meant to conceal. That's the nature of the charge. Haha, this was an illegal campaign contribution from the Trump Organization, because that's a separate organization. Now, if the Trump Organization had paid Trump money, because he's CEO, and then he'd taken that money and paid it off, you know, then it's you can spend as much of your own money as you want on a political campaign, obviously. So it's going to be a little bit weird to even try and claim that Trump's organization's money wasn't his money, right? It's a little, so this is all very, very, anyway, you can feel the reach. This is like stretching for the, you know, doing whatever is necessary. Okay, that's interesting, but it comes with costs, right? There's actual political, sociological cost to all of this, where this is going to inflame a lot of folks, and it has. And it's Rorschach test. I see people on the left couldn't be more excited. People on the right couldn't be more incensed. Their Venn diagrams are not overlapping. There's like zero agreement around this. A lot of whataboutism. What about Hillary? What about, you know, it goes on and on, right?
Yeah.
In truth, we have a swampy, swampy DC. The whole thing needs to be like indicted and taken out for a little ride behind the woodshed. Okay, carrying on. Here's where Mr. Bragg's legal problem comes in. Was the hush money a campaign contribution? Was it? The governing statute, the Federal Election Campaign Act, which, by the way, I believe makes it a federal... What?
Nothing.
Makes it a federal thing rather than a state thing, but that's okay. Provides that a contribution is any donation made for the purpose of influencing any campaign for federal office. Purpose... Okay, it's any donations for influencing... So you can make the case... We wanted her to be quiet. That influenced the campaign. It could have had an influence on the campaign. Okay, so the problem here is this. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held that because campaign finance laws infringe on core First Amendment activity, they can't be dependent on vague, subjective interpretations like this one they're trying right now. Accordingly, the clause for the purpose of influencing any election... federal election is an objective standard. It's highly objective. As another section of the statute states, an obligation isn't a campaign expenditure if it exists irrespective of the campaign. In other words, if campaign funds pay for campaigning, they pay for campaign manager salaries, ads, travel, venues for rallies, polling, all that, but they don't pay for the personal expenses not created by the act of campaigning. Even if the candidate intends for them to benefit to the campaign. They put some examples down there. Like you say, oh, I need a new $4,000 suit so I can look good and it's going to influence my campaign. I can't buy that out of my campaign funds because that's also my personal, it didn't arise solely because of the campaigning. Lots of people buy suits and they aren't campaigning. Same thing you could say, as they say here, you might decide, oh, I'm going to go join a country club. Very expensive so I can schmooze donors. Still doesn't count because you still did it.
Right, right.
So
that makes sense.
Anyway, that's what they had to do there. They had to stretch like crazy. So what do you think of that? Does it sound, I mean, does that sound like compare that to killing a million Iraqis? I mean, where are we at in that spectrum for you?
Oh my gosh, where are we at? I mean, honestly, it just feels like it's, like you said, a complete reach at this point. And it just feels like people's personal belief systems are bleeding over into political in a way that is just unsavory for me. I know it gets like down and dirty sometimes, but it feels a little much to be utilizing taxpayer resources to do so as well, right? I mean, they're basically making this giant deal out of it. And trust me, like, I have mixed feelings in some respects on Donald Trump.
Yep.
Personally, but I don't know. Like you said, it really goes to show, I think, the level of corruption overall that's just in the system.
Yeah.
Right? Because these are supposed to be there as stopgap measures, like, you know, the checks and balances that our forefathers, you know, saw fit to put in were to keep things like this from happening, right?
Yep.
Ideally, there would be a balanced position at the end of it all, because nobody had too much power in one direction or another. It just feels like they like this a witch hunt. I don't know what else to say.
Yep. Yep. No, I agree. So let's carry on here then to this next part of this story, which is which is this. So let's
to the us.
Let's go here real quick. I want to talk about this Alvin Bragg guy for a minute. So, because he first, I didn't know who he was, and then he came on my radar screen back in July of 2022. You probably heard this. This is the case of, there was a New York bodega worker. This guy is working in there, and he's attacked by a gentleman, and he ends up stabbing him, and the attacker dies. So.
Oh, I remember this one.
Yeah, you remember this?
Yeah.
So, wish I can't change these things midstream. Unfortunately, that's the one problem with this setup. So the guy who died is Simon. Simon's girlfriend, Mr. Simon, his girlfriend, who's not named in the complaint at all. She had left the store. Her payment was declined because her card didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going, oh, guess I should get some money, she went back and got her boyfriend, Simon. The New York Post obtained a surveillance video of the incident and reported that the woman is heard saying, "My N is going to come down here and F you up," okay? Mm. Shortly before her boyfriend, Simon, comes in the store. So she's in the store all hot and bothered, telling the guy back there, "Hey, my boyfriend's going to come in and F you up here." Mm-hmm. Then the boyfriend comes in the store. And let's just go to, it says here, according to the complaint, surveillance video shows Simon carrying a white towel in one hand, entering the area behind the counter where a Jose Alba, that was the bodega worker, sat, and then began pushing him. And it looked like this. So let's see if I can.
It's gonna play.
It should, but it's not gonna. Oh, maybe it will. It's a little jerky because that's how it came out on the security cam footage. So here he is. He shoves this guy. Obviously, you got a young man against a much older man. He's cornered, clearly. Obviously, if this was a policeman, this guy's like full of bullets right now, right? Because the policeman will shoot at your dog if he thinks it's right. So he's like slapping him around. If you could hear the audio on this, which didn't carry through on this, the old guy, Jose Alba, says, "Papa, I don't want any trouble here." But he's feeling very threatened. There's a lot of very bad language going on. And then he takes out a knife and stabs him. Now, what's interesting in this, we don't have to carry this through to its brutal. There's volume on this?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't even hear that. There's nothing coming through our headphones. So I didn't know there was volume on that. Okay, sorry for that. If there was volume coming through, I will try and we'll work that out. So here's how this plays out. Carrying on, second part down there, he says, this is a quote from Jose Alba. He said, "He, Simon, wanted me to come and apologize to the girl. And then I took the knife we used to open boxes and I stabbed him. The complaint states that Simon's girlfriend attempted to pull Alba away from Simon." That's what we would have seen towards the end of this.
Mm-hmm.
"And in fact, Simon's girlfriend then took a knife from her purse. She stabs Alba," the complaint says. "She is not facing any charges. She was never charged."
Wow.
By a spokesperson for the prosecutor's office. So in this whole thing, you know who gets charged? Jose Alba. He gets charged. He gets charged by Alvin Bragg. He spends 6 days in Rikers prison with bail that he couldn't possibly clear. And he was arrested, charged with one count of second degree murder. Not homicide.
Not self-defense.
Not self-defense. Like, shouldn't have been charged with anything. In my world, he shouldn't have been charged. Shouldn't have been charged with nothing, right? He gets charged with nothing. But they charged him with murder, which means you had an intent to kill somebody. You had not, like, you set it up. Like, you were in some way contributing. Like, you caused it. So first off, even if you're in a duty to retreat state, where are you supposed to retreat in that scenario?
Yeah, you're backed into a corner.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, it's against somebody who's larger than you, younger than you, right? Very mm-hmm. angry, right? Mm-hmm. He's got a compatriot on the other side. You don't know if they're armed. You have, like... So, and it all happens very quickly. To be charged with murder is so over the top.
Yeah.
First degree means you planned it and you plotted and you took it out. But second degree means you intentionally took somebody's life when you didn't have to and you planned and you meant to,
mm-hmm.
right? There was some aggravating factor, right?
Yeah.
At any rate.
That's crazy to me.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
So, yeah.
So what's happening now with him?
Well, he's been released since.
He has.
Yeah. So they say that a New York City judge ended up dropping the charge against him. because the prosecutor's office went around and around and around, and they found out that they couldn't actually, nobody, there was not a chance in the world they could convict. But still, he gets charged, right? Still, he spends days in prison. He has to get a lawyer. I mean, this is very, very disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And what's clear is that, and by the way, there's a longer story, which is why this guy was even on the streets in the first place, being released under some of the, here's the thing about these Soros-funded DAs. They like to reduce charges from, a lot of felonies became misdemeanors under there. This is the irony. That's why I'm raising this part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. A lot of these charges, Alvin Bragg reduced 52 felonies down to misdemeanors. So these would be things like attacking bodega workers, formerly a felony, now a misdemeanor. And a lot of people are clearing out and getting back on the streets faster. So it's sort of a soft on crime because it has a racial component, they say. You know, it's unfair.
Mm-hmm.
It would be unfair for this gentleman to have, you know, experienced felonies for having gone back and attacked somebody because he felt his girlfriend was dissed in some way, shape, or form. So that's the whole.
Isn't it interesting how the people that are often in the position of like their own shame tend to lash out that much more? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like the aggressor was them.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me. It seems like a pattern that I notice.
It is a pattern. And here's where I need to go with it. So check this out. Just yesterday, because today's April 2nd. A Manhattan garage worker was charged with attempted murder after shooting a thief. Listen to this. A parking garage attendant, he confronts an alleged thief. He sees a guy looking in windows at the parking lot where he's a security. Goes up, confronts the guy. The guy pulls a gun out. They wrestle for the gun. And during that wrestling part, the garage attendant gets shot in the stomach and in the ear and pulls the trigger and ends up harming this other guy. They both go to the hospital. They're both apparently in stable condition. It is the parking garage attendant who was charged by Alvin Bragg's outfit here with attempted murder.
What? Wow. Okay. That is a pattern.
There's a pattern developing. Do you
feel
it?
Whoa. Yeah, I do. I do. Okay.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Carry on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's where we're at in this particular story. It's not good. So here's what I want to do. There's been this developing thesis. Evie and I have been we've been wrestling with this over breakfast for many a day and on walks and everything like that. And so it's really just trying to figure out like what is actually going on. There feels like there's a pattern here.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going on, and it's not just people making a few bad decisions now and then. There's a pattern of bad decision making
mm-hmm.
that we're facing. And it's almost like, and this brings us eventually, trust me, to the idea of national divorce, because there will come a moment where I have irreconcilable differences with how Alvin Bragg wants to go about doing his business, but he has lots of supporters. There are lots of people in New York, which by the way, if you live there, leave, right? So there are people there though who support that. They support the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, coming forward and still masking children and enforcing, you know, they're really just in your business. But I think we have to understand, like, why are they being this way? Because I'm a huge individual responsibility, Second Amendment. My home is my castle. If you're in my house or you're in my, you know, behind the counter at the bodega, it is my right, my duty, my obligation to mm-hmm. defend myself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you abdicated all your rights when you decided to come and enter in and be violent. So question is, what is going on? So you remember this, Evie? Remember we just read this one?
Oh.
From Dumb to Dangerous?
Yes.
It came out February Ooh. 24th. This was, who is this? Was this Hurricane Rider or was this, I forget. I'm so sorry. I forget. Somebody, a member at our site, I'll dredge it up, posted this and said, oh, this is an interesting article. I read it twice. So good. And it's actually asking the question about what's going on with the millennials, the Gen X's, as a mm-hmm. cohort, mm-hmm. right? So always beware the old people saying this generation stinks, right? But there's a pattern here. So I just want to go through it and cover mm-hmm. it because it seems important.
And we're also, not like singling out these people and pointing fingers. I mean, I just to preface this, when I read this, I felt like this individual who wrote it was definitely coming from a point of view and has an opinion about these things. So this is not factual, mm-hmm. and it's not, you know, banging on the millennials and the youngers, you know, to say that we think ill of them.
Yeah.
However, I think it is, it's a good explanation potentially, or hypothesis into why things are the way that they are and continuing to go that direction in this country, at least.
Yep. All right. Well,
I'm sensitive to this. Maybe it's because I was born right before this.
I think you're in the mix here, honey.
No, I'm not. I'm not. If you look at the date, it says anyone born between 81 and the mid 90s.
All right. That's good.
You're, okay. I just made the cutoff.
Born 1980?
Okay. Yeah.
All right, here it is. Let's talk about this because again, this is not to sweep everybody with the same brush, but it is trying to look at some patterns that I think are relevant and explanatory, worth discussing, and that's what we're here to do, see if we can add context to the story. All right, quote, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up is a book by Mark Burlin, and it's a sequel to his best-selling 2009 book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. I bet you would bond with that book.
You think?
Yeah. Evie is constantly talking about how you're not a technophile. She thinks the technology it's a two-edged sword, but one edge is sharper than the other, that actually the benefits we get are often outweighed by the downsides,
yeah,
the cons.
I think so. It might not be evident right now, but I think when or if all of this turns off, we're going to see where the real strengths lie. And it's not going to be around pushing buttons and knowing how to code. It's going to be like, do you remember how to take care of yourself in your actual life? Like grow food, process it.
Sure.
You know,
and that seems, and other things too, potentially, such as how to have an argument or how to exist in the world and think a critical thought. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the thing.
Emotional intelligence, etc.
Absolutely. So, carrying on, quote, both books deal with millennials, the generation usually defined as anyone born between 81 and the mid-90s, and the author, who taught English at Emory University for many years, has had a good look at this generation. His first book was widely reviewed, with many critics commenting on its dire predictions for the future of millennials. As the title implies, Professor Burlin's new book explores whether these predictions have been borne out. He argues that they have. There's nobody quite as cranky as an old English professor, but they've seen, and of course now they're just ruined by ChatGPT. Right? Like, how will I know now? But I've heard this a long time. People have steadily lost the ability to write.
I've heard that too. I've seen it.
Because writing, so isn't that fascinating that Martin Prechtel, if you go and you study with him, right? And he's a how would I describe him? An indigenous elder kind of guy.
He's
got some real shaman with some incredible life wisdom. But when he's giving you his downloads, he insists that you be doing something with your hands, like knitting,
mm-hmm.
Or you know, twisting cordage, or just something, because he says there's a connection that happens between your hands mm-hmm. and your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking back to, I remember first and second grade, we had these big stupid lined paper with a little dotted line in between the two
yep.
fatties, and you had to make letters over and over again, the whole page of A's, right? The whole page of B's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number two pencils, like, right? That was, but that's where it began. That was my foundation of learning how to construct words,
mm-hmm.
was literally starting with the fractured pieces, the letters themselves,
mm-hmm.
right?
And it was connected. Do they not do that anymore?
I don't think so.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I know they definitely don't do cursive, so people don't handwrite anymore. And I definitely think you're right. I think doing things with your hands, like pressing the letter G, maybe it's the same as writing it.
Yep.
But often I'll handwrite things when I want to think about them a certain way, because
right.
it goes in differently than when I'm typing.
Yeah. You ever tried writing with your left hand?
Yeah. I can't reread it.
No. All right. Quote, like Professor Bauerlin, I recently retired from many years of university teaching, so the gentleman writing this article, also a university teacher, quote, a good portion of which was spent trying to understand the problems of my students, who changed dramatically over the course of my 30-year career. Toward the end, I was teaching Gen Z, the generation after the millennials, who, if anything, are worse. My students combined ignorance with strident moral certainty. Possibly the most striking thing about high-profile millennials like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They seem to have had no general education at all, lacked the most basic knowledge of history, even recent history. They were immature and emotionally fragile. Many could not handle criticism, no matter how sugar-coated. It took very little to reduce them to tears or to send them into fits of narcissistic rage. Mm-hmm. They were shockingly bereft of intellectual curiosity, and many gave the impression of having no internal life at all. So.
Is that true in your experience, what you've, I don't know where, how you've interacted with this generation, but maybe from what you see online, or what's your experience been of what you just read? Have you noticed that?
Well,
because I know we've run into it a little bit ourselves here on the farm.
Yeah, it's, I think everybody, every generation thinks the prior generation's got, you know, huge defects or something like that. But there's something clearly going on now, which is well beyond that. And so as we rotate our Rubik's Cube of understanding, one face we look at and we say, oh, you know, this is evil corporations doing this to us. And, oh, it's, you know, it's Chinese, or it's, oh, it's the end of the age of oil, and we're all just nervous. We're trying to understand what's happening here. Certainly there's a strain now in many Western countries, which I judge to be highly immature and completely ungrounded in reality. Right? Oh, we're going to get on windmills. We all need to be on windmills. It's like, could you just spend 5 minutes thinking this through and looking at the data, right? It's kind of like, you know, I've noticed this over and over again, where there's a strain of people and who are in power, many of them, who lack the ability to connect incentives with outcomes. They don't understand that if I do this, these things will happen, right? So consider the case. San Francisco decides, you know, our morals, our ethics, our sense of, our ideology says that these poor people who are struggling with addiction, you know, we should make this easier on them in some way, shape, or form. So we're gonna give them $968. I don't know where they came up with that number. $968 a month for an addict who provably, you know, has a condition. So there, we're being helpful. That's their ideology. It's like, you know what? We're being helpful. Surprise! All the addicts from all over the West Coast figured this out and swarmed in, right? Like, they're like, what happened? Right? It's like, oh, you guys, that was not a hard one to figure out, you know?
What would you have done differently?
Not done that. right? Well, it would be, this called moral hazard. It's a very simple thing to understand, that the central banks don't understand it. They conduct moral hazard all the time. The, you know, it's just Janet Yellen doesn't get it. Like, lots of people don't get it, but it's weird to me. It'd be like this, like, say, Evie, I'm head of a life insurance company. And, I think it's just, you know, the biggest tragedy is when when parents lose a child. Mm-hmm. I just think that's awful. And so I've lobbied Congress and they've agreed, and we all agree, it's the worst thing that can happen is when a set of parents lose a child. And to help soften that blow, we're going to pay $5 million of national money to any family that loses a child. Fast forward 6 months, like, wow, a lot of kids are dying these days, right? Because that's just how it's, how, sadly, it's how it would work
that
out.
That probably is how it would work out.
It's how it would go. All right, so let me know. All right, so, but this really caught me here. It's really caught me here. Which many part? Could not handle criticism, no matter how sugar-coated. No matter. They can't handle any criticism, not even if it's sugar-coated. And it took very little to reduce them to tears or send them into fits of narcissistic rage. That. So I hope, what do you got?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think for... It speaks to some level of just almost, I mean, it's saying adolescent, but immaturity, right? Mm-hmm. And narcissists, generally, the main issue is that they have issues that stem from very long ago that they weren't able to get through, hurdles they couldn't, you know, get over. And so then thereafter, they're sort of soaking up way more time, attention, resources than they really should be at a certain age, right? Mm-hmm. Like, adults that are narcissists, like, need the attention to be on them at all times, right? And they don't know how to fade back into the background of just being a part of the community, it yeah. seems. So, like, I'm wondering what happened to these people at a developmental period that would make that the case. Like, is it that because they were on screens constantly and exposed to so much technology that they didn't get the human contact mm. that is required to help them get through those developmental periods? Because
you remember, so I when I was growing up, when I was a little boy,
yeah,
the way you would learn not to be a jerk to somebody is when they hit you in the head with a plastic telephone, right?
Or a wiffle ball bat.
Or wiffle ball bat, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever the story was, right? But it comes from that actual human interaction. So screen time is not human interaction. No matter how witty your texts are, no matter how engaging the phone calls are, it still doesn't have that analog resonance of connection. Right. Where there's 1,000 signals coming off you right now that I'm aware of, right? Many I'm not. And that's part of the
right.
connection.
Like, there's facial, there's body language.
There's energetic stuff happening.
Right, there's vocal.
Sense, there's little tiny micro expressions, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, you're right.
That all factor in. It's very, very, it's very complex. Like, taking somebody who lacks the ability to read faces mm-hmm. and trying to get them up that curve is very hard.
I know, we're going right? to see that after the masking.
After the great masking, right? Which, again, New York was all like, yeah, let's mask our children up and let's keep them masked the longest. So let me know if the sound comes through too loud on this. Ryan, can you monitor that? But this is, the setup here is, there's a woman, Rychik, on the left here, who is the, she runs a, I don't know if it's just a Twitter handle, but anyway, she runs the site Libs of TikTok. And she had been maligned. In fact, Ocasio-Cortez had told a lie about her in Congress, a proven lie. Had been informed that she was about to tell a proven lie and told the proven lie anyway. And so Rychik went down to the Capitol building and filed an ethics complaint against AOC.
Mm-hmm.
And then just happened to bump into her in some sort of a commissary or something there on the Capitol. And AOC doesn't know who she is at first and then figures out who she is. So let's play this. So that's Rychik on the left, AOC obviously... Rychik on the left and AOC on the right. So let's play this. I hope it's not too loud. Let's see what happens here.
Super transphobic, and I never want to interface with you. Thank you.
I am here outside the Cannon Building. I was here last week because I attempted to ask AOC why she lied about me in a committee hearing. She cowered away. She refused to talk to me. So I'm back here today, 1 week later, and I'm going to deliver her an ethics complaint that I filed for lying about an American citizen in a committee hearing.
So AOC, she broke the rules. Believe it or not, there's actually rules on Capitol Hill. And 23 Clause 1 is a big one. You got to act in a way that reflects credibility on the House. And lying about, you know, a U.S. citizen certainly doesn't do that. So we're filing this ethics complaint.
Let's go inside and see if she's there.
How are you doing? Stopping off some mail for the Congress.
Hi. So basically, a few weeks ago, AOC lied about me in a committee hearing.
Okay.
So I tried to come last week and talk to her, but she kind of cowered away, wasn't interested in talking to me.
Okay.
So together with Mike from the Heritage Foundation Oversight, he helped me file this ethics complaint. So we filed that. And if you can give it to AOC,
sure.
I would really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And tell her to stop lying about American citizens. Okay.
Thank you.
I just dropped off an ethics complaint.
All right, now here, now we're getting to the money shot here.
And unfortunately, she wasn't there. So we left, and then I was walking through the Capitol, and guess who I bumped into?
Watch this interaction.
I just delivered an ethics complaint to your office because you lied about me in a committee here.
Oh, hi.
Yeah,
yeah, no, actually,
I never
actually,
fired a bomb.
No, you're actually super transphobic, and I
okay.
never want to interface with you. Thank you.
Wow.
How about that? How about that? You are actually super transphobic and I never want to share space with you.
Done.
Peace.
No, she doesn't know how to have an argument to the point of that.
No. So for me, the whole idea, like that represents that narcissistic, like unable to have a debate of any kind, unable to hold a conversation, and just gets into that narcissistic rage right away. It's like, oh, you're transphobic. I can't have anything to do with you. Now AOC and other people like her, the question would be, how would you go about modifying your enemy's thought patterns if you could, I don't think storming off by calling somebody and labeling somebody a name. Oh, you're transphobic. You're a Nazi. You're a racist. You're a whatever. Well, as soon as you do that, you label them and bail. Obviously, there's no conversation. There's no point in having a conversation. So the question then becomes, who can you, how would you bridge that divide?
Mm.
How would you begin to bridge that particular gulf that might exist there? When you have an adversary, in essence,
mm-hmm.
who is saying to you very clearly,
mm-hmm.
I hate you. I don't want to talk to you.
What?
Your turn.
What would I say? I mean, if I were in the woman that filed the ethics complaint mm-hmm. and I was, or if I was in AOC's shoes, which one are you asking me?
No, you're not AOC in this story. You're somebody else.
But I mean, I personally feel like just getting onto common ground and hearing somebody out, isn't that an important part of it all? I mean, having a discussion. So if AOC was unable to hear what she had done that somebody else considered to be, you know, a lie or something untrue, like, she had a duty to stand there and say, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I'll look into it. Or I apologize if that wasn't accurate information or whatever, unless she meant to slander somebody.
What did I say?
Right.
Oh, I tried never to do that.
Yeah.
That's outside of my ethics wheelhouse. Did I? Wait a minute. I know. I'm pretty sure I didn't do that. What did I do? Right?
Yeah.
The problem is she actually did.
Yeah. And she didn't care.
And she didn't care. Right?
Yeah.
So let me see if I can... Yeah. So if we go back to this piece right here, right? It says, they were immature and emotionally fragile. I would consider AOC to display that looked immature and emotionally fragile to me, how she behaved right there. Couldn't handle criticism. Didn't mm-hmm. matter if it was sugarcoated. You know, Rychik was being, I thought, fairly pleasant. Oh, hey, smiley. You lied about me, right? So hard as that was, wasn't sugarcoated enough, but I don't know if it could have been sugarcoated enough. And then it took very little to actually send them into a fit. So off she ran, right? And I'm not here to pick just on AOC. I think she's emblematic of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like that.
Well, our emotional intelligence seems to have dropped, right? For all that we know and all that we
yep.
are in our lives, I think what I'm coming to understand, and this is just like a large umbrella sort of perspective, but when we're feeling an emotion, it's not here. It's in our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
It's in our whole being. It's not just our brain. And we can talk about how we feel and think about how we feel, but that's not the same as feeling how we feel. And so what I think happens in those situations is that people get triggered, go off that cliff of trigger, don't know how to handle and manage themselves, and just sort of spaz out. And, you know, it's just not good emotional intelligence or
right.
skills related
to that.
Those are
going to be so important coming up into this next future, right? That emotional, that emotional fragility, that brittleness,
mm-hmm.
that is a huge liability. If you get into a situation where all of a sudden the future isn't easy, comfortable, nice, warm, embracing, all mm-hmm. knowing and loving around whatever, you know, defects I might have. If I fall apart at the first sign of trouble, I am in deep doo-doo when it comes to what's coming in the future, right? Where things aren't going to be that easy going forward. If we have a financial crisis, like I think is coming, or we have an environmental crisis, or we have an energy crisis, doesn't matter, right? It gets harder. So you want to make sure you come into those hard moments with like a good tool set.
Mm. I'm curious about what our listeners think about that. Like what in your book you think the most important sort of communication skills are that you know of to sort of diffuse situations, how you handle conflict. This channel is the poster channel for triggering. Woo!
Yeah. The poster channel for triggering. Well, we're just trying to help toughen you up there, Jock. So this is how we help toughen the world up. So you're easier to control if you're easily emotionally triggered, says D.E. Sakona there.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's absolutely correct, isn't it? That is the point, that if people have no inner strength, no emotional grounding, no compass, no stake,
mm-hmm.
and they fly off the handle at almost anything, well, then isn't that just what we see in our media? Remember, it was the corona Oh no, it's all these horrible unvaccinated people. Oh no, it's actually Ukraine. Oh no, it's one thing after another, right?
Yeah.
And they just, but they, the, here's the thing I don't understand about the people who are triggered by these things. They don't circle back and go, wait a minute. Wasn't I just burning buildings down around BLM just last summer? What happened to that? Do you hear anything about BLM anymore? Remember, it was like the biggest thing right before the election, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like things were being burned.
Yeah.
It was that important. And you'd hear daily about some transgression between police and a black person. That went away. But that'll get resurrected. They just keep churning these things out on a grievance wheel, you know, an emotional grievance wheel.
Somebody said rats in a cage, which it is.
You're absolutely right. Rats in a cage. That's exactly what it is. So people should not choose to willingly be a rat in a cage. I think once you see that framing, you know, just get out. You want to get out of being that rat in a cage, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those of you who don't know, a rat in a cage is a metaphor for the idea of actual studies that were done with rats in cages, where if you put one rat in a cage that had nothing in it except a floor that would shock it, and you administered shocks randomly, painful, the rat would learn to deal with it and not be happy, but it would deal with it. But if you put a second rat in the cage and do the same experiment, administer these painful shocks, now each rat has something to blame its upsettedness at, its anger, its rage, and they will fight. Shock-induced aggression, it's called. Google it. Tons of stuff there. I have an episode on rats in the cage. But that's why when I see things like what's going on in France right now, right? So everything that's going on in France is these people like, oh, how could they be this violent about raising the retirement age from 62 to 64, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about that. It's that they're being shocked. They know it. They know that there's a corrupt leadership that wants to, mm-hmm. you know, 62 becomes 64, becomes 66, becomes 70, becomes never, right? Well, you know that, right?
And Macron, like, didn't he supplant, like, what he was supposed to be doing in terms of, he went around Parliament, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I get what you're saying.
Yeah. All right, so, let me carry on with this then. So carrying on, same article from Dumb to Dangerous, again by the writer there, wrote, it is difficult to get a class discussion going because my students were often unwilling to make judgments of any kind. Partly, this was because they had an intense fear of offending anyone. But, in addition, they professed to believe that everything is relative and therefore wrong to judge, completely unaware of the fact that this itself is a judgment. You should not judge. That's judgment. Ah, damn it. They also saw no inconsistencies in espousing relativism and then in the next moment denouncing their political opponents as evil. Whoops. In general, their moral reasoning was framed exactly in these sorts of black and white terms, an issue that's very important for Professor Bauerlin, as we shall see. But in their own behavior, they were often shockingly amoral. Many lied to me, and I caught large numbers of them cheating on assignments. They were always looking for shortcuts. Almost none did the assigned reading. Many lied to me, shockingly immoral. So that's the AOC clip, right, that we just saw, isn't mm-hmm. it, right?
Yeah.
She's caught lying about somebody in a way that puts her whole self and the office in disrepute, which is a big part of the office, right? You know, judges have to act a certain way, Congress, there's a certain level of gravitas you're supposed to carry into a role like mm-hmm. that. She mm-hmm. didn't care.
She didn't.
You're a transphobe. Talk to the hand. Storms off, right?
You know, I have to wonder from a neuroscience position, whether or not people, like, just dopamine and the way that, like, I just see this trending in a place along with technology and how it's hijacked our brains. Like,
yep.
What's happened to people so that they no longer, reach for those other extracurricular things or ways to give themselves more wisdom and knowledge by reading and researching. And, you know, where did that go? It seems like, I don't know. Kids are after other things, and it's certainly not necessarily.
I'm glad that I grew up without a lot of screen time. And if it had been there, because I would have used it, but I read a lot. And I think that was real. I think something about reading just goes in the brain differently,
mm-hmm.
settles in.
Yeah.
There's something about that act of being sucked into a book, and mm-hmm. you're there. You know, it's some part of it gets you out of you into this other place.
Right.
You know?
And it's experiential during a time where you may not be able to go out and gather those experiences, but personally, but you get to put yourself in the shoes of whoever's.
Do you remember what was the first book you read that just like sucked you in?
Oh, I read the Laura Ingalls Wilder series over and over when I was little. I loved those. Many others. I mean, I read Shel Silverstein, like all of those silly poems.
Yeah.
And, I don't know.
Yeah. For me, it was, I was 12. It was Lord of the Rings.
Oh, did you read that?
Just, I consumed the whole thing, read all of them and started at the beginning.
There's so much in those. Those are hard to read.
I know. And I tried to get into Silmarillion, which is this thing, but it was all like Joseph Begat, Lord. I didn't get into it.
Yeah.
Disappointment. But anyway, so. All right. So carrying on. So where are we at here? Carrying on in this article, because it gets somewhere, trust me, we're going somewhere with this. He writes here, continuing, quote, a very sizable percentage of students had a documented learning disability that I was required somehow to work around. Many of them had been diagnosed as somewhere on the autism spectrum. They often seemed disconnected from their bodies and from nature. In my last several years of teaching, more and more identified as transgender. Most of my students seemed desperately unhappy and unfulfilled. I became convinced, and still am, that something had gone seriously wrong with these people. Yes, it's true that the older generation has always complained about the younger generations, probably since human life began. But the millennials and Gen Z seem to have problems that are unique and uniquely bad. Bad for them and bad for society's future. If these are the people who will be in charge one day, it really is not hard to believe that we are doomed. End quote. Too much?
That's a little heavy for my Sunday. No, I'm just kidding. We have these conversations all the time, but
a little heavy.
Well, it's just intense. I mean, it's an indictment on yet one more thing, mm-hmm. I think, that you could say that, you know, we could improve upon as human beings in this scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we don't have a lot of extra
track
to sort of figure it out before the runway falls off into the ocean. You know, we got to get this thing in the air.
Well, I agree. And speaking of which, shameless self-plug time. I wrote this back in 2011, and it's a crash course. Good news. It's been completely overhauled and updated into this new version, which is, should say, if I had a newest version, it would say Wall Street Journal bestseller, because we did make the list. This gives the explanations, I think, for why we're seeing so much stress and trouble. It is a point of view. Remember, I keep talking about rotating the Rubik's Cube. This gives you the resource view. I think everybody should look at it, read it, at least to dismiss it in their own minds and say, you know, you're full of crap there, Chris. But it's all data, and it's just putting data in a way. And I think we are on a deeply unsustainable trajectory. And as humans, we're receiving that on some level, right? Every organism has the intuitive capacity, which just simply means something operating below our cognitive threshold, but we're receiving the information somehow that says, time to move to the next valley. There's no next valley in this story. We've eaten through the resources that we have in many respects. And so we have to get into a new, much more balanced, nuanced, more adult arrangement and relationship with the world and our resources. And we're careening into that moment, this moment of crashing into these limits that we have with some of the weakest, most ineffective leaders that we have. So that's why I put these pieces together. When you have the AOC, you know, you're a transphobe, can't talk with you. That's not the kind of people we need right now. We need adults who can sit down, add 1 + 1, get to 2, have differences, are able to disagree, because there's no right path here. There's a lot of hard choices we have to make. Well, you can't get to a hard choice unless you know how to disagree. So that's important there. And by the way, that's also available in audiobook now too. So for those of you who are more listeners than readers, good news.
Not read by you though.
Not read by me. Nope.
But still really cool.
You know what I found out about that they were even thinking of making an audiobook is when I received the notification that there was one. I didn't even know. Thank you, Wiley. That was awesome. Way to go. All right. So here's where this is now. We gotta go. Now we're down to it. All right.
Okay.
So this is just from a place called Love with Intelligence. It's about what happens if you are personally in relationship with a narcissist. But I think we can use the same frame to understand narcissism at more of a collective say, a leadership level, because the traits are the same. Mm-hmm. So see if anything sort of resonates with this. There was a definition of narcissist, but I think we all know a narcissist is fundamentally somebody who is so self-absorbed that they suffer from what you might call first character syndrome, right? They are the main character in everything, and the whole world has to revolve around them and what they want, when they want it, and how they want it, and how they want it to look. And it all has to be constantly feeding them, and they will maintain relationships on the basis of being fed in that way, and they will sever or even damage or destroy relationships if they're not getting what they want in that moment out of them. So that's narcissist. All right. So first thing they write here, quote, to remember about narcissists is that they need to be in control, and they also need to be right. Boundaries get in the way of both things. They can't control the narrative if you put a roadblock in their way, end quote. So to me, that exactly describes what we're facing in the media right now around the COVID narrative, around the vaccine narratives, around the early treatment narratives, around the clean energy narratives, the climate narratives. They've all been co-opted by people who are just absolutely unable to cope with anything other than complete control of the narrative. And if you don't toe the line on that narrative in that moment, they cancel you, they shadow ban you, they squelch you. I'm convinced that all of big tech has been, if they aren't like groovy hip bros and gals out there trying to like make the world a better place, they're just raging narcissists who just want to, you know, sell you another dopamine hit and get richer so they can look good at the next party they go to. That's what I think that's the whole thing. Right?
Yeah.
All right.
I think that is a great point.
And by the way, both of us were raised by narcissists, so we have a pretty strong sense of what's involved here.
We do.
First-hand experience.
Woo!
Talk to me.
I know.
When you set a boundary, the narcissist, see it as you questioning what they're doing. How dare you question them? They're always right. And then they just bulldoze straight through the boundary like it was tissue paper. Don't even try to explain why you're setting a boundary with them either. Narcissists don't care about your feelings. They genuinely aren't interested in how much happier you'll be with boundaries in place. They don't want you to be happy. It's irrelevant. No, they just want you to keep supplying them with attention. And as a result, they only care if a boundary affects them and their access to you.
Mm. Yep.
Is that any
familiar?
Is any of that familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, we're the poster children for that.
Yeah, I see a lot of that in what we've been seeing of late in the people out there and how they're responding and you know, all of that, what's going on and how everybody's behaving. It's there's a lot in that. They don't want the boundaries. So here's where I'm going with that. You ready?
All right, I'm ready.
Here we go. First up, how do narcissists react to boundaries? Oh, that's easy. They see the boundaries as an attack on them, even if they're not. This was one of my biggest, most important life lessons, is that, you know, you put up with something and somebody's just like intruding and it's subtle at first, or maybe it's really overt, but it gets worse over time, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you finally set the boundary and you say, oh, no, I'm here. Mm-hmm. This is my personal. They get violently mad sometimes, really angry, as if you attack them. But that's how they experience it.
Mm-hmm.
AOC, yeah, I think, felt she was attacked by that woman in that place. And she was just like, dude, I filed an ethics complaint. You lied about me. That was an attack.
Mm-hmm.
AOC will then, I'm sure, go home or talk to whoever she talks to in her private moment saying, oh, my God, I was just attacked by another one of these violent transphobes today. And they're all like, oh, my God, that's awful.
Mm-hmm. Right. And she'll use it to build her argument about how the world is all wrong.
Mm-hmm. Again, not to just pick on AOC entirely, but she's a convenient poster child for this whole thangy thing we're talking about here.
Not that we're diagnosing, we're not, but
I am. No, we're not. Well, maybe. Okay, learn how to identify, and you got to learn how to disarm narcissists. Important life lesson here. Walking away from a narcissist, they write here, and having boundaries will only get you so far. Being able to spot a narcissist and turn them away will save you from heartache, psychological drama, and please don't think you can rely on your intuition or your intelligence to see narcissists for what they are. Narcissists have left some of the most intuitive and intelligent people in pieces because they didn't see the narcissist coming. Why is that? It's because narcissists are masters at bending and flexing to appear the way you want to see them. And unless you know what to look for, our Identify and Disarm Narcissist program will teach you exactly what to do and how to see it. So there's training you can get in this. It's based on the valuable research of Chase Hughes, a world leader in behavioral profiling. So you can actually get training on this. I advise people, you should get training on this. You should figure this out, because this, I see a world of damaged, traumatized, narcissistic people out there flailing about, right? But you can't negotiate with them. There's no peaceful, reasonable negotiation to have with people who are in that mindset, because the only negotiation they are willing to entertain is, are you willing to completely concede to my needs or not?
Right.
It's not a negotiation. It's a, are you going to completely do what I need you to do or not?
Yep. It's a one-way street.
You can't convince them. You can't control them. You won't open their eyes up. There's no magic combination of words.
You can't give them good data. Data doesn't matter.
Data doesn't matter.
That's what I found really frustrating.
Yeah. So anyway, what does that actually mean and look like? So I think there's a larger thing going on here, though, which is this. You remember this case? We talked about this, too. This one really bothered me. So this is in Ireland. And I believe in many cases that Ireland and the UK and all of that is really a test bed for the next stupid thing they're going to try and shove down our throats. Right? Sort of their petri dish for awful social experimentation. Sometimes it looks that way to me. So at any rate, this is a story about a man, 17-year-old. Dean Carey, right? So this is from last October, 2022. Quote, a man who stabbed and killed an intruder who had attacked him in his home in the middle of the night has been jailed for 3.5 years. Dean Carey was 17. He stabbed 25-year-old Jack Power in the chest on the 26th of July after Mr. Power entered his home, they say. How do you do that? Mr. Power, get this, 3:30 in the morning, threw a rock through the front window.
Oh.
Enters the house at 3:30 in the morning, believing something, you know, that they had a squabble. Carey stabbed him once in the chest, and then this Mr. Power collapsed outside.
Wow.
That's it. Mr. Justice Paul McDermott said he had to accept the jury's verdict that Carey had acted in self-defense, although, he said, the convicted man had used excessive and disproportionate violence by using a knife on someone who was unarmed. And by the way, I forgot to bring a picture up, but this kid is like, he's skinny. He's got two ears like this that just stick out.
Yeah.
And he's just a little kid. And the guy he stabbed was a big guy, right? So imagine this, you're in your home. It's 3:30 in the morning. Crash, a rock is thrown through. A violent drunk dude is in there. He's raging. You pick up a knife and stab him once.
And you're in jail for 3.5 years.
Now, what's the way I interpret that? It's that what they're trying to say is that you have no right to self-defense, because in the world of a narcissist, when you can put up at any boundary whatsoever, that's when they feel threatened. So the narcissists that are now running this overall thing that's happened, you know, the UK, the US, they want us completely disarmed, not necessarily because they don't, fundamentally, they might go, you know, you have a right to defend yourself, I guess. You know, it would be a theoretical right. But when it comes down to it, if you're a bodega worker or you're shot by a guy in the parking lot in that case that just happened in Manhattan, or you're in your own home in the UK, in Ireland, right? And somebody busts in your house at 3 a.m. who's large and violent and intent on doing you harm and who's drunk, you can't defend yourself. Now, why not? I think we have to go back to what we just heard about and talked about with respect to narcissists. They don't like it when people are able to put boundaries up. And there is no more relevant, rightful boundary that exists in this whole story than your right to defend yourself in your own store behind the counter, in your own place of work, and in your own home.
So do you see the people in our leadership that are blocking others from being able to defend themselves? Like whoever decided this case, right? Maybe it was a jury, I don't know, or it could have been a judge, right? Just a judge. But do you feel like those people themselves are struggling with narcissism in a way that keeps them from like allowing other people to defend themselves?
Well, now we have to distinguish. There's individual narcissism, and then there's this cultural narcissism, right? So there's clearly people now in the United States and in the UK, but I'll talk about my own country, in the United States now, who want us to go down this I can't even call it a communist path. They're, as they describe in this article we've been reading about Dumbed and Dangerous, right? They're actually utopians.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that there's this better world. If we could just stop people from defending themselves, then we'll get to this better place. If we could just stop people from misgendering people, then if we could just stop people from
right.
then, right? It's this if then, but it's not connected in any, there's no grounding in history. There's no like, oh, great, show me, when did that work last time, right? Like this whole idea, like, you know, fascism's really bad. You hate Nazis. We get it. Because look how many, 6, 12, 20 million, whatever you score the number. That's how many people Nazis killed. But the communists, they put that to shame.
They killed a lot of their own people.
A lot of people. Mm-hmm. Mao, Stalin, Pol Pot. When you go down the list, it's not cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have that grounding, right? Because when would you have learned that, right? So, but that's what I feel. I feel this is all in, that's what Alvin Bragg actually represents. That's why when he files a charge against Trump, I'm very much of a mind that I'm looking at this in a larger sweep of saying, wow, this is an activist district attorney who is critically vital. His worldview says, I want people to there is no real law. There's subjective law only, and there's no ability for people to defend themselves. That's it. He wants the power of the state to be absolute.
Mm.
And will do anything, bend laws, break laws, not follow laws, over-apply laws, whatever he has to bring that ideology forward. So I don't share that ideology at all. I don't know where the overlap is. I don't know where where's our common ground? We both want the world to be a better place. Okay. I just am very realistic about how you make the world anything at all. It involves real people building things and taking risks and other people not taking that away from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they feel like it.
Mm-hmm. Somebody was saying in the chat, we all have narcissism and other traits within us. And
we do.
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong.
We do need to focus. The only healing we can do is in ourselves. That's it. Like, I can't control your narcissism and you can't control mine.
Right.
Right.
And knowing this is what we call critical framing at Peak Prosperity, having the framing of it and then working with it over time. I've learned that I don't have time to spend time with every single human who comes into my field of view.
Mm-hmm.
So then I get to discern and choose. And given the choice, I would much rather spend time with people who are nourishing and uplifting than people who are corrosive and destructive. Mm-hmm. And I get to choose. So being able to spot them quicker, hey, this person's going to nourish and excite and interest and elevate and build together. Hey, not this person. You get to choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Thank goodness. Yes, we do.
So
have that choice.
Now we're finally down to the final last bit of this, which is the idea of, is it time to discuss a national divorce? Casey Flores put this map together and sort of drew it at the county level. So It's not at the state level. Drew it at the county level and said, it might look like this, right? Notice he left all along the top border there. There's a northern corridor. So he hasn't bisected it, meaning there's a left and a... Like, I'm sure that those northern counties in Montana are going to be like, the hell you say?
I know.
But this is what he was trying to think it through. And he also noted that, you know, he left a Pacific access down there in San Diego on that little red down at the bottom. So the red states have access to the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. And then the blue states or, you know, whatever this national divide to be, you know. Anyway, that's just how he divided up. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's a starting point. To have that conversation.
Is this based on any voting whatsoever?
This would mostly follow the voting patterns, except for that northern corridor.
Okay.
allowing the you know, the divorce state on the left to, you know, traverse if... Anyway, that was just sort of an idea. I've seen lots of other different ideas, but...
Yeah.
So, a divorce happens. When does a divorce happen? It happens when you get hit with irreconcilable differences in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes, you know, would you rather have a civil war where everybody fights it out and there's lots of murder and mayhem, or do you just call an audible on the relationship and say, you know what, you people in New York, you be you. You guys, you know what, charge the wrong people, flail around, make a mockery of the law, abuse your children, you know, go for it. You be you.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to have to fight you over that. And you shouldn't have to fight for your right to be that way. If they want to be that way, they should be that way. but they should not be in a position of forcing their same behavior sets on me if I don't want them.
Mm-hmm. My brain's just playing around with the implications of a national divorce. It's like, whoa.
Well, it begins with recognizing that there are such things as irreconcilable differences. It begins, which might be, this is from Wikipedia, around divorce and marriage. Any sort of difference between the two parties that either cannot or will not be changed can be considered an irreconcilable difference. A difference that could be that of a difference in character, personality, belief, mm-hmm. or some other personality trait. Right. So the question before us now at this point in time is, are we at a part of the national dialogue where we can just call an audible, lay down the weapons and just say, look, have we just grown apart? Are we just so different in our orientation, values, beliefs, traits, personalities, all of this and that, that it's time to just separate? Do it amicably, do it as peacefully as possible. But it's the grand experiment of America is now broken. And I believe it got specifically broken by people who were trying to break it because they believe in their heart of hearts that in order to build back better, in order to have a great reset, you have to first tear everything down. It's a very childish, immature view because obviously by doing it that way, you risk tearing it all down and then it stays torn down and broken. It's a really stupid idea. You never tear something down and then build the better model. You do what Bucky Fuller said. If you want a system to change, you don't tweak it, you build a better model. And then people will beat a path to your door. That model will win because it's superior. Capitalism, before it became all corrupted and a kleptocracy and the stupid thing, we don't have capitalism in this country right now. We have cronyism at best, right? So that was a better model when it first came out, though. The idea of individual property rights, individual rights, personal freedoms, patent protections, intellectual property protections, those were unique in the world at the time. People mostly lived under feudal systems and that had gotten sclerotic and useless over time. So America was that shining light on the hill. People came here because it represented those things. It doesn't anymore. Those things are gone. So why not just talk about that? There are people who do not believe in individual rights, individual responsibility, the right to self-protection, right to self-determinism, the right even to decide what goes in your own body. There are people who do not believe that. And I think that's an irreconcilable difference with myself. That's how I see it.
There it is. Boundary.
Set the boundary.
Laid out. Somebody was saying the mainstream media should pay for all the cost of the divorce.
They should.
For every aspect of that.
Yeah. Ed Roberts asks, Chris, how do you feel about being in the gray area? Is that like where we live, technically?
Yeah. We're not in...
I know. It's kind of gray area.
We were never like... I hate this. I hate getting into the political piece, but it's impossible not to, right? I mean, obviously people gravitate to one group or the other because they see themselves in those people. I no longer see myself in this, you know, with the general amount of people in Massachusetts, for example. Mm-hmm. I no longer see myself represented by those that are in leadership positions here or in the White House.
I love the people that in our town.
Yes.
It's kind of Eastern. Yes. There's a tale of two states here, just like in Washington State. Western Washington, Eastern Washington, totally different places, you know?
How do you divorce if
Well...
Stitch it, cut down the middle.
Yep.
Stitch on another state.
So Chris, where are we moving? VT Gothic's in the... VT Gothic entered the chat.
Oh, VT. Hi, friend.
I don't know, buddy. Call me. We'll talk about it because we're going to have to figure that one out. All right. So we got to get... I told you I was going to get somewhere with this. I promise.
All right.
We'll get somewhere. So... Examples of irreconcilable differences then would be when you have a lack of communication, when you have an inability to agree on a work-home balance, right? Excessive arguing, differences of opinion regarding religion, politics, finances, children, and a lack of emotional or sexual intimacy. I would argue that to reference that at the sort of collective level, we are not sharing emotionally resonant space as a people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's been fractured. And by the way, I do put a lot of blame on that, on the media, on the social media companies. They specifically drove those wedges. The president of the United States right now, he's not out there saying we anything in a collective sense. He's saying we, my tribe, against these awful MAGA Republicans. We, the vaccinated, against these awful unvaccinated. He is the most divisive, most poster child president in my lifetime for this fractured, narcissistic, bully, rage-infested. It's just awful. It is gross. Not at all. What the CEO should be, the visionary of your company. The president needs to be the person who is there holding the higher ideals that you aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's micromanaging our gas prices and shaming individual groups and just being, weaponizing the FBI against political opponents. It's gross. It's really nasty.
He's a criminal.
It's not good. So here's why I think we're at the national divorce stage. You want to know why?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that we do in our seminars at Peak Prosperity is we have these really awesome things. Like this subject here is one we would dive into. And one of the years we dove into the ways in which relationships could be strengthened, because our core belief is that to be really resilient, you got to be on board with your partner. You got to be locked in, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's ways to get in alignment, and it turns out that your relationship, whether or not you're coming into tough, turbulent times or not, is the most important determinant of your happiness and your kids' happiness, So you need to be solid, and the kids orbit around that solid son of the husband and wife. So anyway, it's John Gottman is a relationship guy, and he sat down and they filmed couples together. And he can now, after years of doing that and examining the micro expressions on their faces, could say within seconds, nope, this couple will not make it, or they will. And so they found that there are four horsemen of the apocalypse when it comes to the relationships, right? Criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. So, you can read those. They're pretty obvious. Criticism is about attacking the character of your partner, critiquing what they do rather than their behavior, exaggerating. You owe us. You never.
Oh, we know those words. That's how you know when you're triggered.
That is when we're triggered. We say, you owe us, you never. That's
and
how
then
we know.
Laugh about it, though. Like, I never do this. Like, I always.
Mm-hmm. So, and then defensiveness is, you look for excuses. You fail to accept responsibility. You don't admit fault. It's just never my fault. Or stonewalling, withdrawing from interaction. You ignore the partner. You shut everything down. You evade conversation, by starting other activities. Yeah. I saved the best for last, though, which is contempt.
Mm-hmm.
Contempt, disrespect, mockery, sarcasm, insulting, eye-rolling, scoffing. Because, why did I save that for last? Because John Gottman said, the four horsemen of the apocalypse are those things. The worst of these is contempt.
A lot of people feel that way, actually.
Contempt is when you a little... Can't help that little sneer thing, when you're contemptuous about somebody. So that when you detect contempt in the relationship, he's like, it's over. Call the audible. We're all done here.
Mm.
Right. And one of the key things that he wrote here that I liked is the way you detect contempt is that if they are statements that come from a relative position of superiority. And again, it's the most destructive of the four horsemen. So it's that relative position of superiority, right? You're a transphobe, can't talk to you. I'm higher than you.
Mm-hmm.
That was a contemptuous display.
Mm-hmm.
There is contempt from our ruling bodies and our organizations. There is contempt for the little people. You don't deserve to know what happened with your money at the NIH. You're going to have to pry that out of our hands, and then we're going to redact everything. Why? Because we hold you with contempt. We are superior to you. Our government no longer serves the people. It is now, it's been inverted, and they hold us in contempt at the same time, right?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I agree. I was just reading something funny. Somebody said,
well, call it out.
California, no, it's gone. California and Utah haven't banged in ages or something like that. People were discussing the divorce. I just got sidetracked. I'm trying to track the chat.
Good. Well, the call them out when you see them, because it's harder for me to see them when they're over.
No, you think in long form. It's too hard. Anyway.
Contempt is when there's no room for hope, says Doug. Absolutely right.
We read these, by the way, so thank you for your, you know, activity in the chat. We'll laugh about it later.
Yeah. Amen, Chris, preach. And by the way, this is such a content-rich environment. I've had a lot of good content coming up, if I do say so myself, but the one on Testify, if you want to check that one out, the preach about testifying, about how it is time to talk to the faithful, that it's that the time of trying to reach across the divide to include everybody in the conversation is over, because we need to make sure that our side, our troops, if we have a side, is rallied to the cause and is morally and energetically uplifted, that there's nothing wrong with preaching to the choir. This is a Matt Walsh concept that came out. And so I talked about that. That led to a really big conversation. We had like 400 comments on that one. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it got stimulated a lot of great thought. So if you come by Peak Prosperity, want to see that conversation, that's where your tribe is hanging out. People who have conversations like this. Civil, open-minded, go there.
Thoughtful. Wow. That's a lot of stuff that we just crammed in, that you just crammed into that presentation. So good. You're not done yet, are you?
It popped out my little head. It just happened. So anyway, this was just sort of a way to look at it in a bubble relationship. And that's it. That's the last slide. So, but I just think it's always a good time to learn how to have better relations and how to know yourself. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I think back to like the thing that's really missing for me from when that person was talking about the dangerous and dumbed down generation,
mm-hmm.
the piece that's missing that really caught me, I don't know if you notice that, but he said, I think these people lack an inner landscape.
Yeah. There's no internal world or right. something like that. Yeah.
No inner world. And that's what's really missing. That's what's really important. If you don't have that inner world, there's no there. There's no center. There's nothing to build off of. So everything must feel like a threat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no, you are an egg without a shell, you know? Just a membrane.
Right.
Right? Little gentle.
Which is, I mean, I just have to say though, my thought on that is that when children are growing up and their parents are expecting them to perform for them, and they're not allowed to create that inner world, I mean, I believe the outcome is just like we see it then. Do you know what I mean? I believe that as parents, it's our job to, you know, hold our children in a safe way, but to hold them loosely enough so that they can become what they need to become. So I'm just wondering how children get that way, because my brain always likes to figure out like why something happens and to break it down. You know, just it seems to me that the way that we've ended up in this position, both as a country and as a people, as a community, is that some things have gone wrong. And perhaps that list is very, very long. And, you know, and we can only change ourselves. But I'm just curious about it.
Hmm. Well, it really does matter where we are in the story, and so I do wonder if this is a fair characterization. But that these three paragraphs, particularly those last two, caught me. My students combined ignorance with strident moral certainty. And that's the opposite to me of having integrity, which is the highest definition I know. To be in integrity means you are ready and willing to be completely re-educated at any moment in time. That is, you're so firm in your sense of self that mm-hmm. your identity isn't wrapped up in what you happen to think at the moment. You're willing to just change. Like new data comes in, you can just change. That means you're so solid. You have that integral core that can't be shaken.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you have to defend something or be sensitive about something, it means you're not solid in it yet.
Right. Like you're identified with the thing and not with yourself.
Right.
And so then when that thing changes or is taken away, you can't adjust.
Yeah. A derivative of that is when Maya Angelou, to paraphrase badly, she said that you finally have arrived as an adult when you belong everywhere and nowhere at once. That your sense of belonging doesn't require any particular outer constellation of things, that it happens, you belong everywhere and nowhere at once.
That's beautiful. I like that.
So that then gets us to that last part, which is, you know, they were shockingly bereft of intellectual curiosity, which is a no-no in my world. I'm like the most intellectually curious dude I know, always like every day. And many gave the impression of having no internal life at all. That's the damaging part right there. No internal life at all.
I feel for these people. I feel for all of us. At this time in history, it's not an easy place to be. You know?
No, and I think it was cell phones. I think it was TikTok. I think it was, you know, really cool, shiny
Snapchat.
Things. Snapchat. We just didn't know how to use it yet. It was new technology, but it was like monkeys with machine guns. It was just out of our grasp. The damage we could do was amazing.
Right.
We didn't quite understand how the mechanism actually worked.
I think that's true. Yeah.
Good. Well, so with that, everybody, we are now wrapping up here. Thank you so much for listening. I invite you to hit the like button, resubscribe if you've gotten unsubscribed. Some of you will have to resubscribe to this channel because it happens still. Join Peak Prosperity if you want to be part of these kinds of conversations going forward. And Evie and I are just thrilled to have spent today here with you. So thank you so much for being here. We'll be back with you next time. And enjoy the rest of your weekend. So long, everybody.
Go get outside.
Go get outside because, hey, that's what we're going to do. All right. Bye-bye.